The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, and 24/7 support. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello and welcome back to Science Weekly from The Guardian. This week, science correspondent Ian Sample meets this man and tries to be, well, risk savvy.
I'm Gerd Gigerenzer and I'm director at the Max Planck Institute for Human Development and also director of the Harding Center for Risk Literacy.
Renowned psychologist and author Gerd Gigerenzer joins Ian to discuss his new book, Risk Savvy: How to Make Good Decisions. Gerd is an evangelist for logical thinking mixed with good intuition and believes that all of us have to be what he calls risk literate.
We need both statistical thinking and good intuitions in situations which are uncertainty, where not everything can be foreseen.
In the interview, Gerd discusses his wide-ranging work as a risk analyst, advising central banks, the military, and governments. Also his work as an author, trying to equip us all with simple rules of thumb that help us make better decisions in our daily lives. Now, you've decided to listen to this podcast, so you're off to a good start. But let's learn more about this uncertain world we all live in with Professor Gerd Gigerenzer.
What are you trying to do with this book?
I'll try to encourage people to take their lives in their own hands. If you read popular books, you may read that most of us are, illiterate, risk illiterate, and irrational, or even predictable irrational, and in need of nudges to behave sensibly, which is also part of your government. My book provides a different perspective. Everyone can learn to deal with risk and uncertainties. And it shows a number of simple principles that everyone can learn quickly who dares to know. And second, if you think that there are experts around, why should I know anything? Just ask them. That may be a dangerous thing. Because many experts, doctors, financial advisors, and other risk experts do not understand risks themselves, or don't know how to communicate them to you, or even have conflicting interests that are not aligned with your interest or fear litigation.
There have been a run of books lately which do paint humans as these sort of, as you say, sort of the predictably irrational, that we are essentially pretty stupid, that we need nudging in this way and that way. Is your book saying that we're not sort of hopeless cases, that can be reversed, or are you taking issue with the fact that we're stupid in the first place?
Yes, I do. I don't think that we are stupid. We are born stupid. Of course, look, who would have thought 100 years ago that we can teach everyone to read and write? And now many of my dear colleagues believe the same about risk literacy. If we don't start to revolutionize our schools and teach young people how to deal with their health, with money, with digital media to control them rather than be controlled by them, then there is no surprise what we see today. And the message that most of us, or all of us, are hopeless when it comes to risk and just need to be taken care like children by parents from birth to death is not a vision for the 21st century.
What are the kind of mistakes that we tend to make, though, with risk assessments?
I give you one example from the UK. In every couple of years, women in the UK are alarmed by news that the contraceptive pill increases the risk of thrombosis by maybe 100%, as one of these scares said. So many women reacted with fear, stopped taking the pill, which led to unwanted pregnancies and abortions. How much is 100%? The study upon which the health authorities disseminated the news showed that out of every 7,000 women who took the pill of the previous generation, one had a thrombosis, which increased to 2. So that's a relative risk increase of 100%. And it's an absolute risk increase of 1 in 7,000. This would be an easy distinction that everyone can learn, but it's not done. And this single scare caused an additional estimated 13,000 abortions in England and Wales in the following year. We could avoid that if we would help people to become risk savvy, and it's not difficult. Just ask, tell me the absolute risk increase, not the relative one. Take another example from healthcare. The point is not just that people have not learned how to deal with risk, but they are systematically misinformed by groups of interest. For instance, women in the UK learn that if they participate in mammography screening, that reduces their risk of dying from breast cancer by 30%, sometimes 35%. That sounds big, isn't it? So you might think out of every 100 women who participate, the life of 35 is saved. No, it's another trick. It's the same trick as before, relative risk. If you look at the real statistics, you find that out of 1,000 women who don't participate in screening, 5 die in 10 years, and out of 1,000 who participate, it's 4. That's 1 in 1,000. It's the same as 5 to 4, 20%, rounded up to 30%. I think it's unethical to try to misinform women and push them into screening. And particular, if you look at the total cancer mortality, there is no life saved by mammography screening. We have no evidence for that. And we waste our money for many screening techniques where we could do something against cancer and for other medical things where the money is missing.
You talk in the book about how we can make strange decisions, bad decisions, because of reacting to events. Like you talk about people taking to their cars after 9/11, after being scared by obviously going flying in airplanes, and how that led to an additional something like 1,600 deaths on US roads from people driving more. But these are very natural reactions that people will have. They will be more scared of flying after seeing airplanes fly into a building and all those people die at once. Mm-hmm. What are the reasons that we feel that way? Why are we pushed into making that decision that we wouldn't otherwise have made?
So the terrorists strike twice, first with physical force and the second time through our brains. And it might be useful to let people know what psychology knows about how their brains function so they can avoid the second strike or be a victim of it. So what is this anxiety the terrorists exploit? It is called threat risk anxiety. And that means if many people die at one point in time, as in 9/11, react with fear and avoid it. Note, it's not about dying, because if as many or more people die distributed over the year, as in car driving, as in cigarette smoking, it's very hard to elicit fear in us. It's a very specific fear that was probably rational in human history, where people lived in small hunter-gatherer bands, where the sudden death of part of it could have threatened the survival of the rest. It's no longer relevant today because we are no longer dependent on the small groups, but it's still easy to elicit this fear. Think about swine flu, bird flu, all these imagined catastrophes that make us uneasy. So if you realize that, then if anything like 9/11 happens again, you know your fear will come up, but then you realize, I will not let the terrorists have their second strike, and I will fly and not jump into the car and be a victim.
How do you use this sort of information and your knowledge in your own life? Do you change how you behave, and do you have to constantly fight your sort of instincts to behave in what you might see as a more rational way?
Oh, yes. My own research on decision-making influences my own life substantially, and it's fun to observe yourself and also try to get the remote control of your emotions in your own hand rather than being from outside remote control. I have learned to make decisions much faster because you realize that you can't predict the future. And there is no way to try to find every piece of information. And it's also more fun to take over the responsibility yourself. And there are many examples. For instance, people, when they go shopping for a pair of trousers, And those who try to maximize will look at every piece and every piece in order to find the best one. But there's another shop, a department store, there's another boutique, and then and at the end of the day, before shops close, they buy something. They're not sure whether it's the best thing. Oh, they will be never sure. It's a recipe for disaster if you try to maximize in an uncertain world. And there are simple rules that may work for you. Just think about what you want. A black pair should not be too expensive and fit. And if you find it, buy it and go and have a cup of tea.
Do you feel a clash in yourself when you're trying to get yourself to behave this way, that emotionally you want to do another thing?
Oh, yes. Everyone has that. But if you experiment a little bit with yourself, just try that. You will see at the end, you are faster and you are satisfied because you got what you wanted. And if you want the best thing, you will never get it. And even if you would by accident find it, you would not know it. So if that decision would be something more important, like you finding your ideal wife, and you are a maximizer and try to find the best one and only the best one, good luck.
So is being a maximizer a bad idea?
Not in general. There are things where it's worse to try. I'll give you an example from a different... So when my mother became blind on one eye, there was a photodynamic therapy, which was unsure. So I called the major doctor who did most of this operation and explained him the situation and asked him, what would you recommend? And he said, just try this type of treatment. Then I realized I asked the wrong question. I put him into a defensive position because he doesn't know whether I might sue him. Huh? So I said, look, I have only one mother. If it would be yours, what would you do? He said, oh, I wouldn't do anything. So you see that not always, but many experts know immediately there's a difference. And here, his mother wouldn't sue him. Every patient needs to know that doctors cannot simply recommend them the best option. And there are three reasons for that. First, a fear of litigation. That's more in the US than in the UK, but still here, many doctors fear that you might be turned into a plaintiff. So they tend to recommend you unnecessary treatment, unnecessary diagnosis, just to be sure, because you will, if you sue, you sue because something not being done, even if it hurts you. Second reason is conflicts of interest, that's clear. So a clinic earns on an MRI or a CT, and it's a loss of money. So you need to think yourself. And third, the lack of training of doctors in medical schools. And in my studies, according to my studies, about 70 to 80% of the doctors don't understand their own tests and the benefits and the harms of the treatments.
What are the other ways that some of our readers or listeners might get around these kinds of things, might avoid these problems? I mean, what are the sort of tips you would give them?
Yeah. So one tip is to spend some time and read about healthcare. And you should read the right things. So there's a term called evidence-based medicine, which is amazing, but it's necessary because much of medicine is not evidence-based. It means it ignores medical research. So one way to find reliable information is to go into the internet and look at the Cochrane Library, the International Cochrane Society. There are many other sources in the UK. There's Bandolier. There are other sources who try to inform you. But you need to be aware. You try to find a group which has no conflicts of interest. And at the end, for instance, as studies now show, much of checkups, screenings are unnecessary. So there is a Cochrane review about all the, about whether checkups help. There are three questions. Do people who participate regularly in checkups live longer? Do they die later from heart attack and also from cancer? Answer three times no. The only difference is that those who participate in regular checkups worry more often. There are false diagnoses. There are treatments that apparently don't help. If you know that, you can still go. But it's important that you take your life in your own hand and not just blindly trust. Many people at least have learned one lesson according with respect to financial advisors. A financial advisor cannot simply do always the best for you, because the person is instructed every few weeks to sell, and what to sell for the bank, not for your interest. So you need to think along.
You were working, I think, some time ago with the Bank of England, looking at some short rules of thumb. Maybe rules of thumb is perhaps a little bit simplified, but that would some methods that might have flagged up a financial crisis.
Yes.
And you talk in the book about how complex problems don't always need complex solutions. And what sort of things are you telling them? What sort of things have you come up with that might help predict the next financial crisis? Or is the conclusion that you simply can't?
I have an ongoing project with the Bank of England. We just published a paper. Andy Haldane, the executive director of financial stability, gave about 2 years ago his Jackson Hole talk on the first of our results called The Dog and the Frisbee. You can look that up. That's after a simple heuristic, making the point that we know, both from animals, from humans, from experts, that it can solve complex problems by simple rules better than by complex rules. And asking, what we try to do is for a program of study, how can we predict bank vulnerability and other things better with simple rules, or also prevent with simple rules better? So, for instance, I once asked Mervyn King over dinner what he thinks. What handful of simple rules would make our world of finance safer, given that the complex instruments used by the rating agencies or by the banks have missed every crisis and prevented none? Mervyn said, basically start with one. No leverage ratio above 10 to 1.
Just explain what a leverage ratio is.
Oh, leverage ratio is, in simple terms, the amount of money that you own, your capital, to the money that your debts. So your debts shouldn't be higher than 10 to 1. And we investigate systematically under what situation, what kind of heuristics would help. This is a revolutionary program, and talk to a banker, they will immediately find reasons why it cannot work. And they have interesting conflicts of interest. But the typical reason is, it's easy to game. But just remember how the entire system has been gamed with this complex method, and a regulatory bank or a central bank can much easier see when a simpler rule is being gamed than these complex calculations and estimations of thousands or millions of parameters that are going on today.
What are the rules of thumb that you found most useful, or you think our listeners would find most useful?
So one simple rule of thumb is, don't buy a financial product that you don't understand.
That means all of them, right?
No. Stocks is fine. You know about stocks. But the complicated derivatives, that if you don't understand, keep your hands off. This simple rule, if everyone would have followed it, the financial crisis of 2007 and 8 would not happen as it happened. Rules of thumb can be powerful. And there are simple other rules that everyone should know. Don't put everything in your basket. Just diversify and such things. Or make a good portfolio and then keep it. Then you save all the profit that the bank takes from every exchange. So these are examples for good rules of thumb.
You talk in the book about how a lot of instruments in the world are set up to create this illusion of certainty in an uncertain world. And why do you think we want that? And why is there why is it difficult for us to let go of that and to actually be comfortable with uncertainty in the world?
Yeah, it is part of paternalism. We all think that we live in the 21st century high-tech and we are free person, we have all the choice. But it's true, the doors are open, but we often don't know what's behind the doors. And one illusion is the illusion of certainty. And we've documented in much research that it's spread all the time. And it's often functional. People want to know from the financial advisor what stocks will go up and what down. An honest financial advisor will tell you, how can I know? They cannot know. But that may not be the right way for business. So if I tell you, and I give you a story about why, that Siemens will go up, you will believe me and like to believe that. Same situation with doctors. Many doctors tell me, I don't know what the problem with this patient. But if I tell him that, he might just go to another doctor who tells him with certainty what's the problem. So the first step to becoming risk savvy is to get rid of the illusion of certainty and realize that we need both statistical thinking when we can calculate the risk and good intuitions and rules of thumb in situations which are uncertainty, where not everything can be foreseen. And that's for me also a vision about a participating demography, not looking for illusions of certainty, but be willing to take the own responsibility and face the risks. In sports, we want to be uncertain. We don't want to know the outcome ahead. And just imagine if we could predict the future in general, how boring our life would be. All the emotions are gone. Hope, surprise. And being happy, being grateful, it's all gone. And life would be like reading the telephone book of last year.
But if something bad happens in your life, and I'd be interested to know if something bad has ever happened in your life that you feel, I could have done more to avoid that. If I'd done a deeper analysis of something, I could have avoided that. And maybe that's what drives people to go through these steps of trying to break down what a risk of something happening is.
No, it's usually you need both. You need a deeper analysis, that is, just get more facts and evidence. But most of the time, that's not sufficient. You need also more. And that's good intuitions or rules of thumb. And the moment you get this together, you can lead a healthier life, lose less money. But in our society, we have this kind of strange idea that calculation, big data, probability theory is always better than rules of thumb and intuition. And that's a big error. We can show, both mathematically, statistically, that in a world of uncertainty, you need to simplify. And the art is often to find out the only important reason. And that's also a rule of thumb. If you don't know what house to buy, whom to marry, because there are one too many. And then you might think, there are several ways. One is you might think, what is really the most important thing for me? And then go with that. Or in case of many people have intuitions that they don't hear anymore. In that case, so if you have a choice between, so assume you have two girlfriends, one too many, and you don't know. A friend of mine was in this situation. He could not decide himself. And there's a very simple method. You take a coin and you throw it. And while it spins, you probably feel what should not come up. So it's a way to listen again to your inner voice.
You went to talk to our Prime Minister, David Cameron's Behavioural Insights Unit fairly recently, our Nudge Unit, as it's known. And what did you say to them? What do they make of your theories?
They invited me because they said they built part of their work on my work. First, I find it good that psychology in general is used to inform policy. Yes. Nudging, that means to guide people from birth to death, is a method that has some justification, but it's not my vision. I want to empower people, to make them risk savvy. And here's the difference. So the Nudge Unit, by the way, I should say, they corrected me when I was there. They said, we are not the Nudge Unit. We're the Behavioral Insights Team.
Yeah, I don't think they like it.
Okay, it's another story. And so the Nudge philosophy is based on a certain part of research that's represented by Danny Kahneman's book, Thinking Fast and Slow, which basically, that research argues that people fail again and again on standard probability problems. There is basically, I make it very now simple, there's no hope for us, and learning doesn't work, and so we need some form of paternalism. It's the only viable alternative. That's what we are. I disagree. First, it is not correct that people always commit this, or most of the time commit these errors. We have shown in our own research that we can make practically all of these errors disappear. You won't find this literature in Danny Kahneman's book mentioned.
Why is that? Do you think, is he not aware of it?
He is well aware of that, yeah. So, for instance, the two of us have had, I've given already in 1990s talks where Danny had a 10-minute response to it and I replied to it, and he's well aware of that. The second point, that we cannot teach people to change, is also not true. For instance, I have taught about 1,000 doctors to do what's called Bayesian thinking, so to find out what a positive test result means. What's the chance that you actually have, for instance, cancer? And they can learn this, and I teach them. They don't learn it in medical school. And it's easy, in 75 minutes, they know it. And we can learn, we can teach, we've shown that we can teach fourth graders to do this apparently too complicated things for us. We can't do that. And so this is why I disagree with that philosophy. It's clear we need some part of strong paternalism. We need traffic laws. Nudging can help. But again, we should invest in people and make them strong.
I want to get to what your ideas are on schools, because I think that feeds into perhaps if instead of having a behavioural insights team, or maybe as well as you want to do something on the educational front. But before that, you've also talked to the security services. And I'm interested in the message you have for them, because they live in an environment which is all about uncertain risks, that is used, their information is used to in a way that ends up, you know, involved with fear of, you know, what people fear happening, what people fear, you know, how people respond after events have happened. What can you tell them that helps them?
So first, I have spoken with many intelligence agencies around the world. And the first surprising thing for me was that they were surprised by the terrorist second strike. They had not really realized that. They're concerned about preventing, which is fine. But it's hard. If you would have risk-savvy citizens who, after 9/11, thought, okay, now the second strike is coming. I fear of flying, so we'll go into the car. I'm not doing it. I'm going back. So that would be a risk-savvy citizen. Second, we work with the German military on helping to reduce civilian casualties in situations in Afghanistan and anywhere in the world where there's a checkpoint, a car is coming, and many civilians have been killed in these situations. How do you do this? This is a situation of high uncertainty. We design simple decision trees that are called fast and frugal trees. And these trees have been shown to save or reduce, for instance, in one case, 1,000 incidents, over 200 civilian casualties, reduced to 70. So here are your...
This simple visual.
No, it's a fast and frugal tree would just... It has to be fast. Mm. The first question is, how many occupants are in the car? If it's more than one, assume no problem. Terrorists don't come in couples to sacrifice them. If it's one, that's not enough. Then a second question is asked, does it keep on the speed or even speed up? Then it's a red flag. Otherwise, a third question is asked, and that's the last thing. Do we have any specific information about that type of car who is now coming? And that's solved. And you can do this in a second or two. And by making that systematic, we can save many civilians. That's the key problems from being killed.
Just want to finally come to your point in the book about how, and I like this way, because you're publicly funded, you want to really be giving back to the people in a way, and helping to educate people to understand risk better. Well, this presumably does need to happen at the school level. And I think in Germany, you've had some success in getting risk assessment education into the curriculum. But what would you like to see being done globally on this? How do you actually do that?
What I would like to see globally done is, first, to change the school system. That would be the most sustainable thing. And generate a new generation of young people who ask questions, who understand how they're being at present being manipulated into unhealthy behavior by the industry, into smoking, into drinking, where they don't profit very much, except suffering and longing, and where they get positive skills that may start from cooking again to knowing how to invest or how to set up a business. And so to get risk-savvy citizens, that would be one thing. And then also us adults to give some tools, which I try to do with these popular books, in the hands that encourage them to take over the responsibility for themselves and also risk to make a wrong decision rather than complain that the doctor did it or the financial advisor. And so at the end, also experts, train experts to be better in understanding risk and communicating risk. And if we can do that, we have a good chance to have a better system of healthcare, to have a better financial system, more less chance of the next financial crisis, and in general, a society which is a true democracy, where people cannot be easily frightened into sacrificing their money, their welfare, and their freedom.
Good. Thanks for joining us on Science Weekly.
Thanks for being here.
Risk Savvy, How to Make Good Decisions is published in the UK by Alan Lane and out in all good on and offline bookshops. That's all we have for you this week. But from me, the risk-averse Science Weekly producer, Jason Phipps, and the more risky Ian Sample, we'll be back next Monday with more great ideas in the world of science. Thanks for listening. Bye.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today, no credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.